So next up, we've got a bit of an update on actuarial guidance. What does it mean, the new actuarial control function, and obviously the practicing certificate that goes along with that. Our presenters are Lisa Pine. So Lisa is the chief actuary of Old Mutual Insure Group. Some of her previous roles were general manager, actuarial at Credit Guarantee Insurance Corporation. She was a founder and managing director at Willis Retails Watson South Africa. And she was also a director at QED Actuaries and Consultants. Lisa has been previously the ASA STIC chairperson, and she currently chairs the Professional Guidance Committee, which obviously ties in nice with this talk. And our second presenter is Jaco van der Merwe. So Jaco is a director at Deloitte, and he heads up the non-life practice area for the South African business. He's got over 14 years industry experience across all the various types of non-life companies, both locally and some abroad companies as well. And Jaco is currently our STIC chairman as well. So please welcome him.
Good afternoon, everyone. We are here to give you a quick feedback. We only have a 30-minute slot, and I realize we're a bit short on time, so we'll do our best to keep it quick and to give opportunity for questions to the extent that there may be. Just as a quick overview, I will talk to you briefly about practicing certificates, and Lisa will follow up with the guidance notes. Both of these areas, as you'll see in a minute, sit within the Professional Guidance Subcommittee for STIC, which Lisa is the chair of. So I think it's worth maybe just starting at the top. So the Actuarial Society of South Africa has a number of practice areas. If you look at their website, you'll see the following 9 practice areas listed, of which we are number 8. Not ranked by alphabetically or size or anything, but I'll give you a clue as to what the sorting algorithm there was. The reason you are here today is because of the Short-Term Insurance Committee. So within the Short-Term Insurance Committee, we've got a formalized membership structure and a number of individuals serving on the committee. Firstly, there's the chair, the secretary, and then our actuarial office liaison. We have 8 specific subcommittees. CPD, which CIAS looks after, which is the chairperson of, and we have to thank CIAS and his team for all the hard work and effort that went into actually putting today together for you. If you've never been involved in organizing an event like this, you've got something to experience still on your bucket list. It's an inordinate amount of effort, and I just want to say thanks to the guys for putting it together. Also on that list of subcommittees, we've got research, education, legislation, with a recently spun out ad hoc committee for IFRS 17 being a very important topic for us, followed by communications. Emerging matters is a new one, and most relevant for this talk, that of professional guidance, with Lisa as the chair. We also have a number of industry representatives, 4 industry representatives, 2 for large insurers, 1 for reinsurance, and 1 for, let's call it, specialist/niche insurance. We also have representation on there from SAIA, SAICA, the Prudential Authority, and I'm very pleased to say most recently we've also created a dedicated role for ASABA. Okay. Drilling into professional guidance, we have 2 work streams or sub-subcommittees, if you like, within professional guidance. Guidance notes, which Lisa will talk to you about, and practicing certificates. So, with no... before I jump into practicing certificates, I thought I'd use my minute of fame up here just to promote STIC in my capacity as chair a little bit for you. Those structures are up on the screen, and the individuals who chair or look after those particular roles are named there for you. They are desperately looking for support and assistance. Bear in mind that everyone who serves on STIC does so on a voluntary basis in an attempt to serve you and the industry. And the actuarial profession. So please, there are many bright minds and willing and able individuals out there, and you can make a real difference in the industry by getting involved. There's a lot of interesting work to be done. But it's also a fantastic way to network, build up your industry relations, credibility, and CV, as well as ticking the CPD box. So please look up there and look afterwards on the slide when it's made available to you, but see if there's anywhere you'd like to get involved. Right. Practicing certificates. So I want to preface this just by saying whatever you see here today is draft. It's hot off the press, only came out of some of the committee meetings in the last week. But I think the right place to start is to say, okay, where have we come from? So the practicing certificate framework for short-term insurance in South Africa was largely put in place, copied off the life insurance framework, to cater for statutory roles, statutory actuaries or signing in a statutory capacity. There were two types of certificates, the general and a limited certificate. And a general certificate being something that enables you to sign off in a statutory capacity as a statutory actuary would for any insurer, for any class of business, for any type of business, for any size, scale, complexity, whether it's capital, reserving, pricing, whatever the case may be, as you can imagine, was a particularly onerous hurdle to cover. And maybe from that, I thought it also good to maybe just share with you just the stats as they currently stand. So the STIC has processed 60 applications over time. 40 of those were unique because some of them were renewals. In that time, in all the years, 5 have been declined. Okay, so maybe less than you might expect. Of them, 7 have lapsed, and this is certificates where people maybe haven't renewed them simply because they didn't need them or they were no longer acting in those roles. I would hope that it's not because they forgot to, but they continue to work, but I'm sure time will tell. Which means we have 28 active short-term insurance practicing certificates currently in the industry for a number of insurers of 100 plus. 18 of those are general, in other words, unlimited, so they can sign anything for anyone. And 10 of those, just about a third of them, are actually limited. Typically, the limitations would be limited to reserving or maybe to a particular insurer. You know, if you've only ever worked on, say, for example, trade credit, that might be a good example why your certificate is only limited to that particular type of insurer. So I thought this was good to put up, and I think it's a question that's often asked, and I think it's good for the industry to be aware of this. You'll see later there'll be even more transparency in terms of certificates and certificate holders going forward. Going forward, we obviously need to revise the criteria. Okay, the role of practicing certificate going forward is to cater for the role of head of actuarial function, which is a key person role. It's a very important stakeholder in the insurance, providing assurance to board. But clearly it's different from what was required in the past. You don't need to have built and calibrated and parameterized an internal model for an IMAP process to be a HAF. Okay, so the role is different. It's that of governance and oversight. And the certificate framework needs to be relaxed. I use the word sort of reservedly, but relaxed to provide for this. We need to also make sure that we are consistent with life. We have one regulatory framework, one governance standard guiding us now, so it makes sense that we are consistent also in our approach. And importantly, I'll talk to you about transitional arrangements because, you know, flipping the switch on practicing certificates doesn't mean that overnight everyone just gets a PC. So a big issue, I guess, for the short-term industry as a very young, immature industry is that we don't have the same years of experience and the same number of experienced individuals, and we want to promote people coming into the industry, getting the certificates, and actually, you know, skilling them up into that role. So we've also put in place, or we're proposing to put in place, some transitional arrangements that will make that easier for members. Right. Now into the juicy bits. It's quite small for me up here. I don't know. If you can't read, please feel free to go through it afterwards. Basically, who needs a PC? Well, basically, if you want to be a HAF in South Africa, you need a practicing certificate. We'll talk a little bit about that now, but the Prudential Authority has alluded to the fact that they may need you to have a PC, but they were kind of a little bit loath to word that in explicitly into a standard. The Actuarial Society, however, does require its members, or does advise its members, to get a practicing certificate if you want to act as HAF, and you can understand why. You also need one if you want to act as a statutory actuary or an appointed actuary outside of South Africa, being a FASA, where there's no international actuarial member organization looking after that. So then we would expect you as one of our members to get a practicing certificate. Or interestingly, when you are reviewing the work of a HAF, so if you're, for example, looking at an internal model that a HAF has approved and reviewed and signed off, if you're going to be giving an opinion on the work of that HAF, I think it makes sense that you would also be expected to meet that same hurdle that individual has to meet. And I guess, interestingly here, is if you're giving formal assurance to your board on internal, or to the regulator on internal model approval process, that previous really high hurdle that we said in the past was a blockage, we will want you to have a practicing certificate for that as well. We are not going to test whether you've met that requirement. We expect the members who have certificates also, to apply their own kind of thinking to that and to make sure they've got the necessary experience. But that is not, we don't want that to be an obstacle now to people to getting their practicing certificates. Okay. Specifically, the criteria are, the general things like we don't want you to have disciplinary findings against you. We want you to acknowledge that you understand the code of conduct, the APNs, the acts, registered service provider, all of those sort of administrative requirements are there for good reason and they stand. You have to be a fellow, a FASA. We would want you to have qualified in the short term unless you can show that you've got a good experience in short term. I think there are a number of people who have qualified not as short-term actuaries but have built up substantial experience. We make provision for that as well. And then obviously you've got to make sure your CPD affairs are in order. I mean, that is an ASSA requirement of you as a fellow. That's not, to have your CPD in order is not a practicing specific thing. So if you want to be a fellow, it's a requirement in any event. But we will also check that you at least have 10 years per annum in short term in the last 3 years, which if you think about it is less than an hour a month. So I think, we'd be very hard pushed to demonstrate that you want to act as a short-term insurance hack if you haven't done at least one short-term hour per month of actual short-term work. So I think that should, in theory, for a half, be a relatively low hurdle. And then I think going forward, we would also look more to ASSA to try and vet and validate CPD and rely more on declarations by members for that purpose. You'll see I put there relevant experience, and that I put it there because it's always been historically an area where the approval committees have spent a lot of time vetting applications, and that's where a lot of the meat sits. So I want to drill into that in a little bit more detail. So, appreciating that the role of HAF as a key control function head who gives assurance to board and the regulator is a substantial role, we want you to have a certain number of years of working experience. We want you to be qualified and to have worked for a number of years post-qualification. This has been put in place, provided this is a draft, this has been put in place to align with what is being done on the life side as well. And actually then the requirement to have years of working experience with another suitably qualified person is still there, but it's been changed from 4 years down to 3 years. Now, I get a question a lot saying, does that mean I need to have worked with another practicing certificate holder because that's the requirement on the life side? No. We changed that requirement a number of years ago to say suitably qualified. So it doesn't have to be someone who holds a practicing certificate. It needs to be someone that's suitably qualified. In other words, has also substantial amounts of experience in short-term insurance, by way of example. And that was also introduced to make it easier for members to get that recommendation. And then we would like you to at least be able to demonstrate that if you've got suitable working experience, that, substantially a lot of it relates to South African insurers. And this is a South African, we're issuing it for South African members. It's a South African role, the HAF role that we're providing this certificate for. And so rightly, I think it makes sense that, having experience of the South African industry is also relevant. We talk about the South African Acts, the APNs. So, I mean, that all is consistent. Okay. As was before the case, the committees can ask you for additional evidence, and that's really because we get such variation of submissions. Some people will say, I've done everything for everyone, please give me a certificate, and some other people will give you a 20-page report saying, you know, I've worked on copulas, I've done this, I've done that. So, you know, in some cases it's necessary to ask for more evidence. What we are doing now, and I think and I hope and I feel that this will be something that will really aid the process, is we are also, we've proposed and we're building in a set of sample questions to guide the applicants and the people giving the reference on the types of questions that we would like them to be able to answer, the kinds of questions that an approval committee would put to you. And those would be things like, give us, you know, it's actually sort of 2 or 3 pages long, but here's some examples of the technical kind of questions we'd like you to be able to answer to show technical depth and breadth. Things around your role providing oversight and assurance, as well as your professional responsibility and accountability. The idea being to establish whether you know, it's one thing having been able to calibrate a really complex model, but have you ever taken responsibility for that at board level? And have you ever engaged with executives and boards on those things? Because that's what's expected of you in this role. And then equally so for the actuary providing the supporting letter, we give some guidance around what that support actually relates to. It's the kind of roles, responsibilities. Is it relevant working experience, and does it include some degree of regulatory interaction and responsibility? Or, interaction with the regulator, let me put it that way. So this has all been built into the revised framework in an attempt to make it easier so that applicants can preempt the kind of questions they might get. So the next point is then, okay, what form will this certificate take? So I've mentioned that the idea is we want to lower the level of the hurdle to make it easier for members, because there are definitely a lot of members who are quite suitable and suitably experienced to be HAFs, but would not under the previous set of requirements qualified for a general certificate. So we're revising the requirements in order to let those individuals also get certificates. From a terminology point of view, we're still going to just have a general, well, this is a draft, we'll have a general certificate. And if it needs to be limited, so if your experience as a HAF would not enable you, for example, to work on a cell captive business, it could be limited. But the idea is that you apply for one certificate with a lower hurdle than it was in the past, and only limited if it's necessary given your specifics. Okay. The general certificate, I want to just again stress and reemphasize, does not require you to have built, calibrated, and take ownership and responsibility for internal capital models as you might imagine in the IMAP process. It was a requirement of the past, it will not be a requirement of the future. Not for the HAF certificate, because that's not, strictly speaking, required of the HAF role. The application process, really, there'll be initial and renewal certificates, and it'll go to ASSA through its TIC committee, and they will issue the certificates. We'll, you know, just also maybe try and remind members to renew their certificates prior to expiry. There are sometimes cases where people forget that their certificates have expired, and then there's a bit of a mad rush at the end to try and get these things in place without putting you at risk as the member. Again, 4 years validity, and what's different here is that the life assurance industry have maintained a public register of who has practicing certificates. We will be doing the same thing going forward. So there's no real reason to keep that secret, but it's not something that was previously published by STIC, but we will make that list available going forward. I think for insurers and employers looking for those individuals as well, it's good to know. Okay. I'm conscious that I'm taking up maybe more time than I'm supposed to, but I think this will be very important and relevant to you. So transitional arrangements. Okay. So on the life side, it's a lot simpler. every single insurer has a statutory actuary. And there's generally a process of converting those appointments so that those individuals are now taking on a half role, because it is different. We don't have that same luxury in short term. Not all of you as short term insurance insurers have had statutory actuaries. One or two maybe, but very few have had statutory actuaries in the past. And we do, as you saw, we've got too few people who currently hold practicing certificates. And even so, even if we lower the bar and open up the application, there are not that many experienced short-term actuaries. And to get all these people issued with certificates overnight is practically impossible. So what's our reason for doing this? Well, given that, we want to encourage the short-term insurance industry to get people through with relevant experience. We want to promote this practice area within the industry. But at the same time, as the actuarial society, we have a responsibility to oversee and guide and look after the level of professional behavior by our members in the industry. So we also don't want to open it completely so that, you know, in theory, we're endorsing someone who comes out of varsity with 6 months of experience, who can call themselves an actuarial individual, to go and take on the role of HAF because the board of the insurer may not be appropriately skilled to vet that person's qualification. Clearly, that would be an unacceptable position to be in. So the idea here is to put in some relatively automatic rules so that for the next year or so, you can get a transitional practicing certificate to take on the role of the HAF if you need to for your business, but with at least some basic minimum criteria. The important bottom line of this is that if you apply for this practicing certificate, the committee is not going to go through a vetting process to vet your CPD. They're not going to vet your experience and ask you, have you done this for that insurer? What methods have you used? They are not going to test and drill into it into that degree. We are going to rely on the applicant to answer affirmatively to a number of questions. It'll be things like, have you worked for 4 years at least? Have you got 2 years of experience at least post-qualification? Is your CPD in order and have you done at least 10 hours of short-term in the year? Do you have some sort of professional or unprofessional conduct finding against you? Those basic admin questions. If the member answers yes to all of those, he or she will get a transitional practicing certificate and will be able to take on the role of HAF under that transitional period with that certificate. You would probably have noticed that the APN 106403 came out in the last week, and it says that the practicing certificate requirements will not be in full force for a period. This is what it means, right? So it's not in full force. We just have some basic requirements in there just to make sure that, you know, like I said, you don't have a fourth-year student stepping into the role with no real working experience. And basically, you just need to get this certificate issued, which is basically a matter of minutes, and it's issued, and that enables you to take on that role. We do then, obviously, however, encourage and ask you to go and get your proper certificate within a year so that you can actually then, you know, fulfill that requirement completely when it becomes effective. That's me. I think there'll be questions, but I'm happy to take them at the end.
Thank you, Yako. Hello, everyone. So I'm going to speak to you about... I'm going to speak to you about the professional guidance that we've been working on over the past couple of years. There are three guidance notes that we've been developing, APN 403, 106, 401, and 402. The one we've spent most time and energy on, and it's really has been very hard work, is APN 403, which deals with the head of the actuarial function for South African insurers, and Yako referred to the practicing certificate requirements for that. So that actually became effective last Friday, and it's the first time we've had a joint APN with the Life Insurance Committee. And I think that we may be doing more work together with them going forward and trying to achieve more commonality in standards. So the role of the HEF is very much in its, I think, in its adolescence for South African short-term insurers in particular. Some may say even younger than an adolescent. And like a teenager struggling to find their new role in society and in the world, there are many questions that we've been grappling with. So who am I? How do I fit in? How independent am I? What qualifications do I need? What can I learn from my peer group? And do I have to do everything myself, or can I rely on others? So to start answering these questions, the first place we look is our big brother, in other words, the regulator in this case. And we can look at the past and the development of the HEF role. So at pre-SAM, we had the statutory actuary, which was very much an established role for life insurance companies, but less so for short-term insurers. Short-term insurers only really had a statutory actuary in very particular circumstances, for example, where we needed to certify reserving on an alternative method to what was prescribed. And then along came SAM, and there were four mandatory control functions introduced, of which the head of actuarial control, or the HEC, was one of them. A bit scary, a bit of a scary acronym, the HEC. But at that stage, actually, for non-life insurers, for short-term insurers, bearing in mind the shortage of appropriately experienced actuaries at the time, it wasn't compulsory, although many companies actually did go ahead and appoint a HEC. Then SAM was actually implemented 1st of July this year, and in the SAM Prudential Standards, in particular GOR 3 and GOR 4, are defined the requirements for the head of actuarial control function, and we're now called the HEF. Which I think is much more positive sounding. That sounds more determined. I have to do this as opposed to the HEC. So that's our regulatory framework. And the intention of APN 403 is to actually flesh out our interpretation of those regulations. So initially, the Life Assurance Committee and the Short-Term Insurance Committee were developing our parallel guidance on how to interpret the HEF requirements. We felt it initially that we would develop independently because we were under very tight time constraints at the time, and also because the life statutory actuary role was already so mature, we felt it went beyond what was actually required in terms of the HEF role. So actually a couple of years ago at this conference, we presented our initial independent draft of APN 403, and then SAM was the implementation of SAM was delayed, and the regulator actually approached ESSA to try and please combine these two notes. So we put an enormous amount of work in working with the Life Assurance Committee to and eventually produced the APN 403, which was published last week. And just by the way, just look out for the group guidance. For the group HEF role, which is expected to come out towards the end of the year. So, just to quickly give you an overview, the contents of APN 403, 106 are here. I don't have time to go through everything, but I'll just highlight a few key points. The first three sections deal with those teenage questions of how do I fit in? So first of all, how independent am I? The GOR3 actually says that the HEF has to provide an independent perspective on risks. And it says there has to be an appropriate segregation of duties from first line. And what we do in the APN is elaborate further on that, saying that the role is one of oversight and review and providing an independent opinion. And further to that, we have to ensure that the board that we're reporting to understands that as a HEF, we're acting in our role in terms of the Act and as a professional rather than as an employee. So that's very important and often can become difficult in practice, especially if you're an employee rather than a consultant. Next question, do I have to do everything myself? So this is relevant because there's a very broad scope of requirements that the HEF has to provide an opinion on, from reserving and capital to reinsurance, pricing, policies and so on. And in many cases, the HEF won't have deep experience or won't have time especially to provide an opinion on all those things. So we do elaborate that the HEF has to be one person. In fact, that's defined in the regulations. But the HEF can rely on other suitably qualified people in their team or external to provide some of the support in this role and some of the oversight and opinion. What qualifications do we need? As Jaco said, according to the GOI, you have to be a member of FASA. You have to be a FASA, and you have to have appropriate qualifications and experience. And in terms of the APN, you do need the appropriate practicing certificate. So, in other words, if you've got a limited practicing certificate, you have the responsibility to make sure that any role that you take on as a HEF doesn't go beyond the scope that both your experience and your certificate would enable. As Jaco said, there is this. We do have the transitional arrangement until April 2020, but there still is the onus on you before taking on a HEF role to make sure that you appropriately experience to take on that role. Even if you have a certificate, it's your responsibility to make sure that you've got the appropriate experience. I'll take you through a few short parts of the contents. The GOR requires that the HEF provides an opinion on the adequacy of the technical provisions and the SCR, and the guidance provides detailed recommendations in terms of what to look at in terms of the data, the assumptions, and the method. In addition, the HEF's required to express an opinion on the financial position of the insurer and dividends, proposed dividends. And in this case, the APN advises to look at the current the impact on current solvency and projected solvency, stress tests, and there's also additional guidance given on our role in terms of the ORSA and risk monitoring. The HEF's also required to express an opinion on policies related to asset liability management, underwriting, and reinsurance, and the guidance says that this should be annually or as required by the board. A very important point and quite contentious in our putting together the guidance was that we believe the HEF doesn't have to monitor compliance with this policy. That's more of an internal audit function. The HEF's role is to provide opinion on the actuarial appropriateness of the policy. The HEF's also required to assess the adequacy of reinsurance arrangements from an actuarial point of view, and the APN gives guidance on how to do that. Another area which requires some clarification is that the GIR requires the HEF to evaluate and provide advice on the actuarial soundness of T's and C's of insurance products. And we had to seek clarity from the regulator as to whether that actually includes pricing and product development. And the answer was affirmative, yes, it does. So there is quite detailed guidance in the APN on the factors to consider in providing that opinion. The remaining parts of the guidance, TCF allocation and allocation of profits reviews in particular, are mainly relevant for life insurers. So we do preface at the beginning of the guidance note, we do advise that HEFs should be should apply the principles as relevant for life and non-life insurers. Okay, so moving on to APN 401, which we're busy refreshing at the moment. The current version, which is still current, is a bit outdated because it refers to particular regulations and accounting standards which have moved on. So basically, we're doing a refresh of the guidance. We've already published the guidance for public comment and received comment. So we're busy incorporating the public comment now. The APN applies to reserving or establishing technical provisions for non-life insurers and non-insurance entities using non-life principles, for example, motor maintenance plans. And it applies for statutory and financial and other purposes, for example, commutations. The changes to form and content in terms of the guidance. The changes to form, it's more generic. We haven't used referenced the specific regulations because we don't want it to become outdated. We've updated the terminology. There was quite a fair amount of detail which we thought was unnecessary and have removed, but we've also added new sections to make it more current. So, for example, we've added more specific and clear reference to ULA reserves, unallocated loss adjustment expense reserves, and we've added guidance on how margins should. We would prefer that margins are specific and explicit rather than implicit. We've added that a movement analysis is required, and we've added a section on reporting. Then the last guidance note, which we actually started work on and actually went very far, was what we call, it's our APN 402, and it was intended as an overarching framework to give actuaries in short-term insurance an overall framework of which regulations, which actuarial guidance, and which accounting standards should be referred to when doing your work. We believe it's a very useful framework, but as we were developing it and based on the feedback we got, we realized that it would become outdated almost the minute it was published and that it probably wouldn't work as an APN because we don't have the resources to be updating it constantly. So what we've decided to do is actually to publish it instead as an article on the ASA website and then possibly to do a refresh from time to time. So that is the work that we've been doing, and thank you very much to all of you on the Professional Guidance Committee, because there's been an incredible amount of hard work that's gone into these over the last few years. Yeah.
Okay, first question, what percentage of current practicing certificate holders work at consultancies? I could tell you, we have the numbers. I'd have to think off the top of my head. I'd say less than half. But that's. I'd have to go and check the actual numbers. I'm happy to update the slides with that percentage, because the slides will be shared with you following this event. So I'm more than happy. There's nothing. Secret about that. I'd have to check the numbers. I don't know exactly. I don't know off the top of my head, but I would imagine it's less than about half, I'd say. How will the CPD requirements of 10 hours be adjusted for outcomes-based CPD? Right. So the requirement will be that you comply with ASA. First, so it's fundamentally the same as it was in the past. So you need to comply with ASA CPD, formal CPD requirements as a fellow. Over and above that, we want you to demonstrate 10 hours. If you want to act as a HAF, you need to demonstrate 10 hours. So really what that means is if you are on outcomes-based, you will comply with outcomes-based and you will maintain your logs in that fashion. But the 10 hours is a requirement over and above that, so it doesn't negate or conflict with that. It's really you demonstrating that you've done 10 hours of valid CPD or 10 hours of professional development over the years. So it remains an over and above requirement. It doesn't change because we move from hours-based CPD to outcomes-based CPD. What's the demographic breakdown of the 28 PC holders, race and sex? So it's very skewed. So we have, out of the 28, I think there are one or two non-white practicing certificate holders. So it's very skewed in that regard. In terms of gender, again, I will gladly add these numbers to the slides. It's definitely skewed as well, not to the same extent. And I'm sort of guessing at the numbers here, not having checked that explicitly prior, but I think it was probably in the order of about five female practicing certificate holders. So definitely skewed there. And I'm actually glad that question was asked. It's a big, you know, the transformation as an initiative for the Actuarial Society is an important initiative for short-term insurance as well. And, you know, from this year, you know, I've stepped into the role as chair this year. We have made, you know, it one of the top priorities of the practicing area, because clearly that number needs to be transformed. The number of practicing certificate holders is to some extent a barometer. We would like over time to see that number move materially. And then I think I ran out of time for more questions.
Thanks. Jaco and Lisa, we'll definitely be passing the questions on to you guys. Maybe then in one of the newsletters of ESSA, maybe there could be some answers.
Yeah. I think maybe just to point out that some of those numbers you've asked today, like I said, I've added them to the slide, but the intention, as I mentioned earlier, is actually we want to publish those on an ongoing basis going forward, because we wanted to get the level of attention and dedication from the industry that it deserves. So those were very good questions. Thank you.
Okay.